You are listening to episode 38 of season 13 of the New World Order for day number 259 of 2019. Hey everyone, this is Klaatu, and in this episode we're going to continue what we've been doing, which is to review commands from the Yuga Linux package. Because as you know by now, we are going over every single application installed by default on a Slackware Linux image, and possibly in some cases on your Linux box as well, because certainly right now we're going through Yuga Linux, and that is typically distributed with everything. Linux is from the kernel maintained, and it's kind of one of those utilitarian Linux packages that everyone gets, even if you don't necessarily consciously use those commands very often or at all sometimes, as is arguably the case today. So the command imcookie is next in our list of Yuga Linux. Its user bin imcookie. And imcookie, according to the man page, man imcookie, get exactly the description here. It says it generates magic cookies for xauth. It specifically generates a 128-bit random hexadecimal number for use with the xAuthority system. Now, honestly, to me, it looks like imcookie is sort of just a dressed-up version of md5sum. I mean, that's seriously what, in fact, that's probably what I'll probably realistically use it for. If I need a random value for a password or something like that, just running imcookie is a quick and easy way to sort of just get that first part of the output of md5sum. And in fact, that's what you could do. If you just type in imcookie, you'll see it in action, and it dumps out an md5sum length hash of random letters and numbers. Of course, they're all actually numbers from urandom. From slash dev slash urandom. If you want to add a little bit of randomness to that, you can use the dash dash file or dash f if you are lazy. And it uses whatever file you pass off to it as a little bit of extra randomness. There's not really great detail in the man page about how it uses that file. What it's doing. I don't know if it's counting characters and using that number as a starting value. I don't know if it's calculating that md5sum and then grabbing another md5sum from urandom and then combining the two or what. It doesn't really say. But let's just try it. Here's a random file in my home directory called package-source.note. No idea what that is. It's probably something ages ago. imcookie-f, that file, term, and I get 12DE, and then a lot of numbers, and then 171F. So I'll run it again, and I get a different A3CF, and then A899. So obviously a different number. So even though you're using, you're not just using the file that you're giving it, it is obviously adding something to the results. And then if I run it again, without any file, I get something completely different. So I'm getting a unique value each time, and that's obviously what you want when you're generating random cookies for an authorization system. I could go into xAuth at this point, because that's really what we would want to talk about to cover what's actually happening here, but I'm not going to. I will say that if you go into the imcookie man page, and it says, typical usage, xauth space add, and this is in the imcookie man page, mind. So xauth space add space colon zero space dot space the results of imcookie, so backtick imcookie backtick. If you run that, bad things could happen. So I advise you not to necessarily run that if you're doing important work on your system. It may cause you to lose authorization to run applications on your own machine. So you would not want to do that. There are times when you would do that, but you wouldn't. I don't know what the occasion would be to run that specific command, because you're basically saying, take my authorization, to use my own display and add a random cookie to it. I don't know how you are then supposed to be authorized to use that, to use your own computer at that point. So all of this stuff is stored in .x authority. That's, if you want to look at it, you can do a cat tilde slash dot capital X and then the word authority, and you'll get a bunch of gibberish that your terminal does not have a display to you probably, and that shows you sort of the magic cookie activity for your current session. You can do the same thing. You can get the same results with the xauth command. Xauth return, it says using authority file home class you dot x authority, and then you can type in, and then you're at a prompt, an xauth prompt, which I don't really want to be at, but I'll keep going with this since I'm talking about it. So I'll type in the list, list return, and it lists all of the different cookies that are, I guess, active on your machine right now. They're MIT magic cookie -1, and they'll show you the hash of that magic cookie. You'll type in exit to get out of that prompt. And that's as far down the xauth the path we will go right now, because, as I say, we're not really on that right now, so it's kind of we're cheating by not limiting our scope to just in cookie. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about that, because in cookie alone doesn't really seem to make a whole lot of sense. And I guess if we're being really strict about it, in cookie is a command to get a random string from dev urandom. Type in mcookie, you get a string. Type in cookie dash dash file, and then a path to some file of your choice, and now you get a different random string with the additional entropy of having been influenced by some file of your choice. It says, use this file as an additional source of randomness. When file is dash, characters are read from standard input. So there you go. That's it. Oh, we didn't run it verbosely. That could be interesting. In cookie dash v or dash dash verbose. And it tells me that it got 128 bytes from dev urandom. So let's do the same thing now with dash dash file, and use my bash rc file as the file for randomness. And it says it got 536 bytes from bash rc, and it got 128 bytes from dev urandom. That's kind of interesting, actually. That's useful to know. So that is, that's how that's being used after all. Now we know. Okay, so that is, that's in cookie. Let's move on to the next one, which is MESG. And you might think that MESG has something to do with DMESSAGE, DMESG. It does not. There's no relation. Message is actually a toggle command. So man message display or do not display messages from other users. The message utility is invoked by a user to control write access others have to the terminal device associated with standard error output. If write access is allowed, then programs such as talk and write may display messages on the terminal. Traditionally, write access is allowed by default. However, as users become more conscious of various security risks, there's a trend to remove write access by default, at least for the primary login shell. To make sure that your TTYs are set the way you want them to be set, message should be executed in your login scripts. There are two arguments for message. There's the in to disallow and the y to allow. So if we do MESG return, it says is in. So if I do MESG Y, it gives me no feedback whatsoever. So I'll do MESG again, and it says is Y. So now it is active. So if someone else was on my network in a terminal and wanted to talk to me, then they could use the talk command or the write command or the wall command and send me a message. This is something that That is, it smacks of old school Unix, where you're at a company and you're all really in the same system. You're all logged into the same system, but the computer on your desk has logged into an X server and is connected, but is connected to file systems not local to your computer. It's very fancy stuff. It's very cool. I got to experience it at a movie studio that I was working at here in New Zealand. It was a lot of fun, and the talk and the write in the wall commands were enabled, and you could get messages from other people from right there in your terminal. It was pretty neat. It was a real luxury to be a part of that system, and I will certainly never forget it. It was just absolutely pure Unix stuff, and it was just a blast to be a part of. So MESG, you can, sort of, it's basically setting yourself away or not away on a modern chat program, like, I don't know, whatever people use for modern chat. AIM? Not really, but Signal? Something like that. So yeah, that's MESG, and that's really everything about MESG that I have to say, because that's really all there is to it. It's a pretty simple on or off switch. I kind of planned to only cover the N's this episode, but that was a lot quicker than I realized. So let's dip into the N section and take a look at the command name-i. Name-i is kind of cool. It resolves path names, sort of, for you. You'll see. So name-i, follow a path name until a terminal point is found. That's not the best way to express what is happening here, but that's fine. So it deconstructs a path for you. So let's go to a terminal here and name I, and I'll just do a //.bashrc. I know that file exists, and I know where it is, so we'll hit return. And it spits out this kind of line item deconstruction of the path that you have provided for it. And the path, and this is a really good one to look at, because at least on my system, I have it pretty well. There's a lot going on here. So F, I believe it's just saying the file that I've passed it is, yeah. The F is the path name currently being resolved. And it tells me that the file name that I've provided is /home/cloud2/.bashrc. Under that is a D for directory, and it's slash. And then under that is D for directory home. And D, cloud2. And then an L. What does L stand for? Well, as you might, as you can probably imagine, it's symbolic link. Both the link and its contents will be output. Okay, so let's see if that's true. So it tells me L.bashrc, and that points to /home/cloud2/.profile. So where does profile exist? Well, under the L is a D, /d/home/d/cloud2. And then finally, a dash, meaning that this is a regular file in the notation name-i, .profile. So that's the full resolution of that name. It tells me the path that I actually gave it. It tells me where that lives. It tells me what kind of file it is. And then it tells me what it actually resolves to. Really, really potentially useful command, I think, as you can probably imagine. Now, if I give it a fake file, so name-i /foo, which I happen to know right now does not exist, tells me all that information. It gives me the directory, and then it tells me, and then it gives me a foo-no-such-file or directory. So it doesn't give you an error or anything like that. It follows through as long as it can, and when it realizes, well, there's no resolution here, it tells you that. It tells you exactly that it doesn't know how to resolve that thing, which is useful sometimes. Now, I understand that a lot of people, in some ways, it's useful to not return essentially true if something is basically an error. And I can see arguments for both ways. And I would love for there to be a switch here saying to error out if there is no file that I provide to be resolved. But there's no allowance for that, so that's kind of an interesting feature of this program. And I think it would probably guide you in how you're going to utilize it, I would imagine. Like, possibly you wouldn't use it at all if you knew that it was going to lie to you and tell you that, you know, give you a list of all these things until it finally says no such file. So anyway, there are options here. Name i-long gives you the long list of the files and directories, so it gives you the file modes, the file ownership, and so on. -m, it gives you just the file mode, so RWX, RWX, RX, or whatever it is. -- no symlinks, or just -n, don't follow the symlinks. So in that profile instance, let's get back up to that really quick and add an n to that. No, it was the -rc, sorry, that is. It just points at the very bottom. It says, oh, it's an L, it's .bashrc, and it goes to profile, but it doesn't actually show you, it doesn't delineate where the profile is. -o or -- owners show owner and group of each file, so it's like the long thing, but without the file mode, it just has the file owners. -v, vertically align the modes and owners. So this, I think that was a -v. Is that a -v? It seems really odd. Yeah, -v. It just makes sure that when you're using, for instance, your -l, everything's lined up. There's nothing's staggered in a weird way. I don't really see the difference, to be honest, because at least in my terminal, the output of -l and -o and everything were already lined up. But maybe I just don't have enough users happening, or enough variety in the file ownership in that particular instance. -m, show, or -x or -- mount points, show mount point directories with a capital D rather than a lowercase d. And I think that's everything. Those are all the options. The original AMI program was written by Roger from tech.com, and the program was rewritten by Carol Zack from Red Hat. Bugs are to be discovered, so if you're looking to find bugs, it sounds like NameI is ripe for the picking. And that's it. That's what it does. What you're going to do with it is up to you. It's an interesting little command, easy to parse. I can see really how it would be really, really useful, actually. I know that there's probably some overlap there with things like dir name and base name and things that are designed to chop up paths, but I kind of feel like there is a little bit of, there's something there to the ability to get a predictable list of the different steps in a path. I mean, it seems weird to just to use it on your own terminal to a file that you obviously already know the path of, but sometimes you don't have that, whether it's because you're writing a script that is going to receive a path that you cannot predict. You know, the user may be providing a path to a file. You don't know what that path is, and you want to be able to establish some things about the file. So you're able to look, you know, if the second line reads home, then you know that it's in a home, it's in the home directory, and maybe that means something to you. If the second line is shared storage, or, you know, NFS or whatever, then you know that it's somewhere else, and maybe that means something to you. And certainly, once again, just using the movie studio that I worked at as an example, you very often didn't know the true path of a thing, because maybe it was on, you know, it looked like it was at slash name of the movie, but it was actually slash NFS slash shots slash name of movie slash scene slash 001. I don't know, whatever it might be. Sometimes you didn't know where the actual thing was because a lot of scripts would abstract that way from you. So that's It's a useful command. That's what I'm trying to say. Now, the next one in the list, NSInter, is a little bit more complex than NameI or MCookie or Message. So I'm not going to start on that one this episode. It is a big, big topic, and I don't know how even to begin to tackle it, since it really requires that we understand namespaces. So I'll need to do a little bit of an introduction to the concept of namespaces, and after that I can talk about NSInter and maybe possibly execute a command with NSInter. But it is a big topic, and we will save it for next time, because I think in the next episode we'll just talk about namespaces, how to determine a namespace, and then NSInter, how to run a program with a namespace of another process. So that's where we'll leave it off right now. Not the episode, just this segment of the episode. The next segment of the episode is everyone's favorite segment of any episode. It is, of course, the coffee break. And we're back. Ideally, you have a cup of coffee. I, once again, I'm not drinking Carl's special coffee that he bought for me. I am still drinking whatever I got from the bin store, because I'm about to move yet again into a house in about 7 days. So I decided to hold off on opening the next bag of delicious C4 coffee for the house, rather than to power through it here at the flat. The house is only about a block away from the flat, so it's an easy move. It won't disrupt anything. Just saying that I don't want it to interrupt the enjoyment of my coffee. That's the important note. That's the important takeaway here. What I want to talk about right now is, I want to go back to the topic that I was talking about in the previous episode, 1337, and kind of talk about how people get started down the path of utilizing open source in real life. I think this is an endlessly fascinating conversation, because it happens in so many different ways, and I'd be fascinated to hear about the way that you handled this in your own life, dear listener, because, like I say, I think it's an endlessly fascinating conversation. I already said in the previous episode how I sort of got started, how I took my existing computer, took a look at all the applications that I was using on it, and swapped them out, just literally swapped them out, like in many cases, deleted what was there, and put an open source equivalent in its place. And that got me 90% of the way there, and then the next 10% was when I installed Linux, and I found that 10% was actually another 100% to go. But that was an effective way, and I think it's a pretty common way. I think that's one of those arguments, I guess, one of the ideas behind cross-platform open source applications, right? You get people ramped up on Firefox and on LibreOffice and on, I don't know, whatever else, GIMP, and then you swap out their OS, they're none the wiser, right? I mean, I'm saying that sort of tongue-in-cheek, because obviously that doesn't actually work. You don't just swap someone's OS out, pull a rug out from under them, and suddenly they're running Linux. You could literally try that. I think I've sort of tried that before. And what happens is that they go to the internet and look for an application that they want to run, and there's no downloadable .exe or .dmg, and they think, oh my gosh, how do I install a thing on this operating system? And then it becomes this whole hairy mess of, well, here's the package manager, and here's the graphical one that only works half of the time, and then that application that you were looking for isn't included in the package manager, so we're going to have to download it separately, and we'll install it as a slash opt, and so on. So you can't do that. But that is an idea. That is a tactic that I think many people have really believed to be the the correct one, the one that we're working towards, is just to make sure that all of those great open source applications are cross-platform, and then people can start using the open source applications, and then basically they're open source users, right? They're running all open on a closed stack, but other than that, they're open source, and that's a valid thing. I mean, there are people out there who are doing exactly that. Their expression of I use open source is that they run open source on a closed stack, and the closed stack is the toaster, right? It's the thing that you purchase off the shelf and it just runs, and that's all that you really care about. It is the appliance upon which you run your actual, like, quote-unquote operating system, if we're saying, oh, an operating system is the collection of applications that you run, which no one says, but let's say that anyway, then that's it. They're on an open source, quote-unquote, operating system, because all of their applications, or at least all the ones that they care about, are open source. Now, I think that the problem that we run into there is that not all platforms are super friendly to open source, an open source, quote-unquote, operating collection, user space application set. They provide libraries or operability layers like Xcorts or WSL, and then they neglect to actually keep those things in running order. And so while in principle it should work, it just doesn't quite work the way that it never quite feels right, or it just crashes or whatever. So there's that problem. And that, again, as I said in the previous episode, isn't really an open source problem. It's an open source problem, but the onus, I guess, is technically on the maintainer of the closed stack upon which it's running. But there's no guarantee there that they're going to keep the open source stuff running. Like, that's not part of the license. That's not part of the EULA that you agree to when you turn on your computer for the first time after you've purchased it. So that's a problem. So anyway, there are other ways, and I want to talk about that. And some of those, like certainly one of those ways, would be the classic virtual machine. And I kind of cringe when I think about virtual machines being sort of the introduction to Linux, because I think, well, it's not the optimal way to experience Linux, number one, and because anything in a virtual machine is not optimal, right? Like, literally, it's not optimized, and it's also just not, it's just suboptimal. You know that you're in a virtual machine, and it feels a little bit different, because maybe there's just a little tiny bit of lag, or you just know. You know that you're in a window mimicking a computer, and it just doesn't feel the same. It's silly, but I think that it does exist. I think it is a thing. And I think in the past, if I'd been transitioning over to Linux now, so the past is now, if I was doing it now, I could see myself saying, okay, well, I will use a virtual machine, but I'm going to set up the computer such that, and I would have hacked it together if I had to, such that after I powered on the computer, the virtual machine launched. And that was kind of my methodology at one point, was to destroy the desktop and to just have a script that ran upon login to launch X11 and launch desktop and all these other things that I'd compiled on the Darwin kernel. And I do mean compile. Like, I did not use a package manager at the time. I didn't know about those yet. I was literally compiling applications. No, that's not true. I think I did know about the Think project. I might have been using some stuff from there, but it was a lot of stuff was hand compiled from manually compiled. I didn't go in and like hack on assembly myself, machine language. But anyway, so that's a thing, right? You could do that, and then it would kind of, there would be a feeling that, well, this is my computer, and I think that's where the whole idea of, well, you have to be running an open stack starts to get wobbly, because at some point the thing that it require that you require to drive your machine is beyond your control. I mean, it isn't, but it also is. And I guess it really is, because I mean, there are still debates today about blobs and firmware and so on, and what kind of code is on that chip that's on your motherboard? Is that open or closed? And, the debates just go on and on. So if you're just launching a virtual machine and that's your computer to you, then who cares what's running underneath it, ultimately? It's a valid question. It's a very valid sort of, like, well, should we care so much about the stack at that point? And again, I think we do need to care about the stack, because once again, the operability upon that stack is not within our control. But if that stack were a lot more minimal, and it's just like, well, you are technically an operating system because you're driving the hardware of my computer, but I'm not interfacing with you in any way except to launch this virtual window. I think that, I mean, honestly, I feel like that would be something. There would be something there. I don't know if it would be worth anything, but it would be something. And I think that's the virtual machine thing. I mean, I have to admit, I ran a couple of things in virtual machines really, really early on, at work, mostly because I didn't have control over the computer itself, and I knew that I couldn't install Linux on the computer, because that would have hindered my ability to do the job that I had at that time. So I had virtual machines that would run Linux, and so I would do things in the virtual machine. I would explore Linux in the virtual machine at work. And that it was a way. It felt very much, and maybe that was partly because of this, that's how I used it, but it did feel very much like a little bit of a taster, a little bit of a dip into the pool rather than full immersion. But it's a valid thing that obviously is a way for people to get used to the idea of, oh, this is just an operating system. This isn't so strange after all. This isn't at all scary. This is a desktop. I know how to use this. I can figure this out. So that's one good way. Run it in a virtual machine. Fire up the virtual machine. Run Linux in there. Start trying to do stuff in that virtual machine. Go full screen for a day and try to get some stuff done. Try to get the stuff back out of the virtual machine. Depending on the host, that may or may not be very easy or difficult, but you could, you know, there are cloud storage methods and so on. So virtual machine is a valid way. Another way is to, of course, one of my favorite ways, I think, is to run something off of a USB drive. That used to not be a possibility, because certain computers, certain hardwares, would block the ability to run an operating system off of a USB key. They just wouldn't, when you pressed whatever special button you had to press whilst booting your computer, it would not show you, it would not give you the option to run the thing off of a USB drive specifically. That was frustrating, but luckily I've not seen that in ages. So if you download a Linux distribution, such as Porteus, which we've talked about on this episode, on this show before, download that, put it onto a USB thumb drive, reboot your computer, snag the startup with whatever key you have to press to get a choice, and then boot off of that USB key. And once again, you're using Linux. And I think that's priceless, because then you're really using Linux. And if you copy the OS into RAM, you can even take that USB thumb drive out of your computer, so you don't have like this thing sticking out of your computer. And you can use the computers normally, and it's a super smooth and easy and natural feeling experience. And I think that's one of the coolest ways to try Linux, is to utilize that ability for Linux to be installed onto a thumb drive. Really simple. So we've got virtual machine, we've got USB drive, we've got another computer, right? That's a perfectly valid method as well, to say, well, I've got my main laptop that I use every day, but there's that one laptop that I've got in the closet or on the shelf, and it was a perfectly good laptop 3 years ago, 5 years ago, but now it's too slow, it's too virus-laden, too whatever. Install Linux onto it. Just put Linux on there and see how Linux performs. It'll probably surprise you, and you can then experience Linux on that machine natively. Once again, it's in a way, it's a good method, but it's also a bad method, because chances of you picking up that computer instead of your main computer, it's kind of 50-50. It kind of depends on who you are. I know that me, if I rescue a laptop with Linux, I'm then usually driven to use it more often because there's a certain amount of pride that comes with that. But I don't think that's necessarily true for everyone. A lot of people like the new and the shiny, and they just prefer to use that newer computer. There's also that drawback of that older computer. If it's a laptop, there's probably a problem with the battery, just because that's usually what kills a laptop ultimately. It's just the 2-hour battery life that it eventually starts to be plagued with. So there are drawbacks to that, I think. But it's not a bad way to get that native experience on a computer with Linux. Now, thinking a little bit outside the box here, there are some things that are distinctly new. Well, actually, I said that, but let's call it distinctly new. One is the Windows subsystem for Linux, WSL, which apparently is WSL2 now. Not really sure what the status of it is. There are blog posts on Microsoft about it all the time, so you can kind of follow along if you really need to. But even with WSL2, the idea is that you can install essentially Linux on your Windows box and have it running as sort of a sub-process. But it's supposedly a completely sort of native and equal sub-process to, you know, it's as equal to any other thing that you're running on your Windows box. And that certainly seems very cool. It's very early in development, so it's probably not the best way yet to experience Linux. But it is an interesting way to kind of get used to the idea of what Linux might be. And this is, I think this would be for the more for the programmer out there. I don't think, or the very, very curious newbie who's completely fine with really kind of hacking on things. And I said that it was a very new thing, but if we really look back, we could cite Cygwin as something that's basically similar enough, right? There are certain parallels there. And Cygwin being, of course, a project that would enable you to run not Linux applications, but applications that are frequently associated with Linux on your Windows box. So a whole POSIX environment called Cygwin, Cygwin. And so it's new, but it's not new. It's completely new because it is actually a Linux kernel. And that's a lot different than Cygwin. But the idea, I think, is kind of the same. And that is to get used to the way that Linux feels on a different platform. And I think the equivalent to that on Mac would be something like MacPorts or brew.sh or Homebrew, as they call themselves, which is just a package manager for Mac. And once again, it's just kind of like this feeling that, okay, this is how we do things on this platform. And to be realistic, that is often one of the biggest, like the desktop experience of Linux is exactly where it needs to be. I don't think that there's anything wanting in the desktop experience and many of the application experiences, especially if you're already using those open source applications on your closed source platform. It's no different, right? It's the same thing. But just the foreignness of, well, here's how applications get installed on Linux. Here's how you activate something on Linux that is not active before. That's a very new and different feel to people who've never maybe had to mess around even with the Windows registry, much less with the cmd.exe or whatever it is. So getting a feel for that sort of workflow, and to normalize the idea that, well, sometimes it's okay to talk directly to your computer. Sometimes you don't have to go through 50 different GUI interfaces. 50 might be a little bit much. 5 different GUI interfaces to accomplish a task. Normalizing that on other platforms, I think, is actually quite healthy. I think it's also, you know, if we're being petty, and I'm certainly not beyond that at all, then there is a little bit of an admission of a victory there, right? I mean, the idea that these other platforms are mimicking Linux in order to to stay relevant, it's outstanding. I mean, it's beyond, it defies belief, right? You wouldn't ever have thought in a million years that there would be a command for installing applications on a Mac. Like, that just doesn't even calculate. Like, the Macintosh is champion of GUI, right? I mean, that's what everyone says about the Mac, is how usable it is and how pretty it is and all these other things. And then to find out that for a good portion of Mac users at a technical conference, Brew is their go-to place for applications is kind of mind-boggling. And the fact that Windows, of all things, Microsoft is shipping a Linux kernel, like literally shipping a Linux kernel with Windows now, it is beyond mind-boggling. It's all very, very unexpected. And it comes in such an unexpected form, I think, for these companies to sort of essentially admit defeat, which sounds really actually over harsh, but let's go with it for now. Admit defeat by mimicking the Linux workflow, which, again, when we talk negatively about Linux, these are the things that people talk about. These are the exact things people cite on Linux that they want to get away from, and it is the thing that is being ported to other operating systems. So it either means that everyone's missing the boat, or that everyone has missed the boat. And I think it's probably the latter. I think people complaining about these interfaces on Linux just didn't get the memo that sometimes it's just better to be explicit and direct than to be pretty and quote-unquote user-friendly, whatever that means. So that's another way. WSL, Mac ports, Brew. Normalize it for yourself. Get used to this workflow of being able to command your computer directly rather than to go through hoops created by another programmer who thought, this is probably the way someone wants to configure their computer. I'll put the button over here, because I imagine that's what everyone wants. Maybe it's not. Who knows? It's hard to say, because that's the only way that you have to configure it. So get used to different ways. Get used to having control over your own computer. And eventually, that sort of thing might become so natural that adopting an operating system that just has that by default doesn't seem like such a crazy idea. And I think in a lot of these scenarios, whether it's virtual machine or USB thumb drive or an alternate computer or WSL or brew.sh, all of these scenarios, or just using a bunch of open source applications until you are using nothing but open source applications, all of these scenarios are ways of getting comfortable with little aspects of computing that previously were not normal for you. They felt foreign, they felt uncomfortable because they felt new and different. And when you make them feel comfortable and familiar and you start to recognize that actually, yeah, this is the preferred method. I'm starting to get tired of going to that one GUI menu and going to that place and doing the thing, or I'm getting tired of having to update my subscription to that thing or to buy a new copy of that other thing. Then suddenly you're ready. You're ready to jump ship. You're ready to go over to Linux. So that's it. Those are my thoughts on the ways that people transition to Linux. And I would be, as I say, very curious to hear from you, dear listener, how you may or may not have made that change, or how you're making that change, and sort of the strategies that you invented for yourself. Because everyone's unique, everyone's different, and I'd be very curious to hear how different people manage it. So let me know, or not. Either way, I will talk to you right here next week. you for listening to the GNU World Order podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Some of the air, so